Remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Biased Algorithm edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Web Wisdom includes Economics for Everyone, History of Consumerism, Evolution, Time Travel, and more. Let's begin episode 354.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Let's start this week's Web Wisdom Show with a clip from the School of Life on the history of consumerism. Let's listen and learn.
For most of history, the overwhelming majority of the Earth's inhabitants have owned more or less nothing. The clothes they stood up in, some bowls, a pot and a pan, perhaps a broom, and if things were going really well, a few farming implements. Nations and peoples remained consistently poor. Global GDP did not grow at all from year to year. The world was in aggregate as hard up in 1800 as it had been at the beginning of time. However, starting in the early 18th century, in the countries of northwestern Europe, a remarkable phenomenon occurred. Economies began to expand and wages to rise. Families who'd never before had any money beyond what they needed just to survive found they could go shopping for small luxuries, a comb or a mirror, a spare set of underwear, a pillow, some thicker boots or a towel. Their expenditure created a virtuous economic cycle. The more they spent, the more businesses grew, the more wages rose. By the middle of the 18th century, observers recognized that they were living through a period of epochal change that historians have since described as the world's first consumer revolution. It was in Britain where the changes were most marked. Enormous new industries sprang up to cater for the widespread demand for goods that had once been the preserve of the very rich alone. In England's cities, you could buy furniture from Chippendale, Hepplewhite, and Sheraton, pottery from Wedgwood and Derby, cutlery from the smitheries of Sheffield, and hats, shoes and dresses featured in the best-selling magazines like The Gallery of Fashion and The Ladies' Magazine. Styles for clothes and hair, which had formerly gone unchanged for decades, now altered every year, often in extremely theatrical and impractical directions. In the early 1770s, there was a craze for decorated wigs so tall their tops could only be accessed by standing on a chair. It was fun for the cartoonists. So vivid and numerous were the consumer novelties that the austere Dr. Johnson wryly wondered whether prisoners were also soon to be hanged in a new way. The Christian Church looked on and did not approve. Up and down England, clergymen delivered bitter sermons against the new materialism. They called it vanity, which was a sin. Sons and daughters were to be kept away from shops. God would not look kindly on those who paid more attention to household decoration than the state of their souls. But there now emerged an intellectual revolution that sharply altered the understanding of the role of vanity in an economy. In 1723, a London physician called Bernard Mandeville published an economic tract titled The Fable of the Bees, which proposed that contrary to centuries of religious and moral thinking, what made countries rich, and therefore safe, honest, generous-spirited and strong, was a very minor, unelevated and apparently undignified activity. Shopping for pleasure. It was the consumption of what Mandeville called fripperies, hats, bonnets, gloves, butter dishes, soup tureens, shoehorns and hair clips, that provided the engine for national prosperity and allowed the government to do in practice what the church only knew how to sermonize about in theory, make a genuine difference to the lives of the weak and the poor. The only way to generate wealth, argued Mandeville, was to ensure high demand for absurd and unnecessary things. Of course, no one needed embroidered handbags, silk-lined slippers, or ice creams, but it was a blessing that they could be prompted by fashion to want them. For on the back of demand for such trifles, workshops could be built, apprentices trained, and hospitals funded. Mandeville shocked his audience with the starkness of the choice he placed before them. A nation could either be very high-minded, spiritually elevated, intellectually refined, and dirt poor, or a slave to luxury and idle consumption, and very rich. Mandeville's dark thesis went on to convince almost all the great Anglophone economists and political thinkers of the 18th century. There were nevertheless some occasional departures from the new economic orthodoxy. One of the most spirited and impassioned voices was that of Switzerland's greatest philosopher, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Shocked by the impact of the consumer revolution on the manners and atmosphere of his native Geneva, he called for a return to a simpler, older way of life, of the sort he had experienced in Alpine villages or read about in travellers' accounts of the native tribes of North America. In the remote corners of Appenzell or the vast forests of Missouri, there was, blessedly, no concern for fashion and no one-upmanship around hair extensions. Rousseau recommended closing Geneva's borders and imposing crippling taxes on luxury goods so that people's energies could be redirected towards non-material values. He looked back with fondness to the austere, martial spirit of Sparta. However, even if Rousseau disagreed with Mandeville, he did not seek to deny the basic premise behind his analysis. It truly appeared to be a choice between decadent consumption and wealth on the one hand and virtuous restraint and poverty on the other. It was simply that Rousseau, unusually, preferred virtue to wealth. The parameters of this debate have continued to dominate economic thinking ever since. We re-encounter them in ideological arguments between capitalists and communists and free marketeers and environmentalists. But for most of us, the debate is no longer pertinent. We simply accept that we will live in consumer economies, with some very unfortunate side effects to them. Crass advertising, foodstuffs that are unhealthy for us, products that are disconnected from any reasonable assessment of our needs. All this in exchange for economic growth and high employment. We have chosen wealth over virtue. An irony-laden acceptance of this dichotomy is what underpins the approach of many pop artists in mid-20th century America. For example, Kleist Oldenburg developed a reputation for taking modest consumer items, many of them food-related, and reproducing them at enormous scale, usually in outdoor settings, in vibrant polyester or vinyl. In city squares, where one might once have expected to find statues in honor of political leaders or religious saints, one now came across outsized hamburgers, giant cheesecakes, huge fries decked with ketchup, or, perhaps Oldenburg's most famous work, a 12-meter-high stainless steel inverted ice cream cone. Oldenburg's vast versions of small things playfully directed our attention to the peculiar dependence of modern economies on the mass consumption of what are, in human terms, some deeply negligible products. Yet the scale of Oldenburg's objects was only superficially absurd, because it rather precisely reflected their actual importance in our collective economic destinies. Nevertheless, as Oldenburg seemed to concede, it was peculiar to be living in a civilization founded on the back of buns and sweetened tomato paste, a bathos hinted at by the deflated, detumescent appearance of many of the giant burgers, hot dogs and pizzas. The one question that's rarely been asked is whether there might be a way to attenuate the dispiriting choice, to draw on the best aspects of consumerism on the one hand and high-mindedness on the other, without suffering their worst sides, moral decadence and profound poverty. Might it be possible for a society to develop that allows for consumer spending and therefore provides employment and welfare, yet of a kind directed at something other than vanities and superfluities? Might we shop for something other than nonsense? In other words, might we have wealth and a degree of virtue? It is this possibility of which we find some intriguing hints in the work of Adam Smith, an 18th century economist too often read as a blunt apologist for all aspects of consumerism, but in fact one of its more subtle and visionary analysts. In his book The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, Adam Smith seems at points willing to concede to key aspects of Mandeville's argument. Consumer societies do help the poor by providing employment based around satisfying what are often rather suboptimal purchases. Smith was as ready as other economists to mock the triviality of some consumer choices, while admiring their consequences. All those embroidered lace handkerchiefs, jewel snuff boxes and miniature temples made of cream for dessert, they were flippant, he conceded, but they encouraged trade, created employment and generated immense wealth, and could therefore be firmly defended on this score alone. However, Smith held out some fascinating hopes for the future. He pointed out that consumption didn't invariably have to involve the trading of frivolous things. He had seen the expansion of the Edinburgh book trade and knew how large a market higher education might become. He understood how much wealth was being accumulated through the construction of Edinburgh's extremely handsome and noble new town. He understood that humans have many higher needs that require a lot of labour and intelligence and work to fulfil, but that lie outside of capitalist enterprise as conceived of by realists like Bernard Mandeville. Among these are need for education, for self-understanding, for beautiful cities, and for rewarding social lives. The ultimate goal of capitalism, in Adam Smith's view, was to tackle happiness in all its complexities, psychological and not just merely material. The capitalism of our times still hasn't entirely come round to resolving the awkward choices that Bernard Mandeville and Jean-Jacques Rousseau circled. But the crucial hope for the future is that we may not forever need to be making money off rather exploitative, silly, or vain consumer appetites. That we may also learn to generate enormous profits from helping people, as consumers and producers, in the truly important and ambitious aspects of their lives. The reform of capitalism hinges on an odd-sounding but critical task, a new kind of consumerism. The conception of an economy focused around buying and selling services and goods focused on our higher needs.
Up next is Han Yung Chang from RSA Animates explaining economics is for everyone. Let's listen and learn.
I try my best to dispel this widespread perception that economics is too complicated for non-economists. And actually, it's very strange because people have very strong opinions about everything. Iraq war, gay marriage, does God exist, you know, global warming. You all have very strong views on these things despite not having a degree in theology, not having a degree in energy economics, not having a degree in international relations. But when it comes to economics, people say, oh, yeah, it's for specialists, you know, I don't know. But why? I mean, if you can have a very strong view on Iraq or Afghanistan without a degree in international relations, you should have a strong view on government economic policy without a degree in economics. You know, I say that this is only because the economists have been fantastically successful in making people believe that it is actually a lot more difficult than what it really is. So they'll tell you, oh, you know, I could explain it to you, but then you don't understand. Yeah? 95% of economics is common sense. Of course, made to look difficult with the use of jargon and mathematics. Huh? And even the remaining 5% can be understood, at least in its essence, if not in all technical details, if someone bothers to explain it to you in an accessible way. For example, what is economics? You know? The ethical foundations of economics. Whether you can separate economics and politics. And how different ways of conceptualizing the economy affects the way we see the world. You know, for example, people think that today's free market economics is a direct descendant of Adam Smith. But this is not true. You know, in Adam Smith and other so-called classical economists, the society, the economy was conceptualized as being made up of classes, you know, not individuals. You know. And the whole theory evolved around how the way these different classes with different material interests behave affect the way capital is accumulated, the economic growth, income is distributed, and so on. Today, in free market economics, that is only individual. You know? When you tell people, oh, that, you know, isn't there a class? They'll say, no, I mean, that's an old Marxist concept. But if that's the case, why do the marketing companies have all these class categories when they do marketing campaign strategy? Huh? Because they'll look at, you know, groups A, B, C, C1, C2, you know, target the advertising according to the type of people. Now, many economists will tell you that economics is a science in which there's only one right theory. There are at least 9 different major schools of economics, And indeed, several more if you count minor schools or split the major ones into sub-schools, each with its own unique strengths and weaknesses. And for free market economics alone, you have three different kinds: classical economics, neoclassical economics, Austrian economics. So actually, there isn't one right theory. And my contention is that we need all these diverse approaches to economics in order to fully understand our economy, because they all make certain assumptions. They all have different underlying political and ethical values. They have all sorts of different theories about how the economy grows and so on. And to make this point, I give you the Singapore problem, or what I call life is stranger than fiction. You know, if you read only the financial newspapers like the Wall Street Journal or the Economist magazine, you'll be only told that Singapore succeeded because of its free trade policy and its welcoming attitude towards foreign investors. This is partly true. I mean, they did have those things, but you will never be told that Singapore government owns nearly 90% of all the land. 85% of housing is provided by government-owned housing corporation, and a staggering 22% of GDP is produced by state-owned enterprises. So in talking about Singapore, I always tell my students, look, give me one economic theory. It doesn't matter what it is, neoclassical, Marxist, Austrian, Schumpeterian. Give me one economic theory that can explain Singapore. Well, there isn't. So you need to know these different theories to fully understand how a country like Singapore could succeed. So in this regard, my advice is that you should not be a man or a woman with a hammer by learning only one kind of economic theory. Because whatever that theory is, once you believe that one theory is true, like the man with the hammer, you will start to see everything as a nail. So I say that you should get a Swiss knife. You know? In this dominant economic theory that is of today, that is neoclassical theory, people are mainly conceptualized as consumers, and work is considered as what these economists call disutility that you have to put up with so that you can earn money with which you consume goods and services and then derive pleasure, or what they call utility. That's your aim, deriving pleasure from consumption. But what happens in our workplace fundamentally affects us, not just our immediate physical and psychological well-being, but also our identity and our sense of self-worth and our self-fulfillment. This is why these days in many rich countries, a lot of people are very unhappy compared to, say, a couple of decades ago, despite the fact that they have higher income. Why? Because the work has become more stressful. But then, you know, economists tell you, no, you should be happy. You know, Britain today has 20% higher income than, say, 1975, you know? Why aren't you happy? Eh? You know, my book is not just an explanation of economic theories and facts. It's also a discussion about the role of economics in public life. And in this regard, I have three sets of observations to make. The first one is never trust an economist. And that includes me. Yeah? You know, professional economists that like to say, oh, we know what is correct, you know. No, they don't have a monopoly over truth. I already told you that there are 9 different kinds of economic theory. So the right conclusion depends on which economist you talk to. You know? And I argue that it is entirely possible for people who are not professional economists to have sound judgments on economic issues. I even argue that sometimes their judgments may even be better than those of professional economists because they may be more rooted in reality and less narrowly focused. And I argue that indeed the willingness on the part of the ordinary citizens to challenge professional economists and other experts is a foundation of democracy. You know, if you really believe that all we have to do is to listen to the experts, to listen to the professional consensus of the experts, why do you need democracy? Yeah, let self-elected elites appoint each other and run the world. You know, this is why a lot of people are unhappy with the European Union. Yeah? The second point is the Latin phrase that is apparently written on the walls of the city hall of Gouda, the city in the Netherlands, which is famous for the cheese. And it says, yeah, I'm not even going to pretend to speak Latin. So it basically says, listen even to the other side. Hmm? And I argue that this is the attitude you have to have in debating on economic issues. I'm not suggesting that you should have no opinion of your own. But what I'm trying to tell you is that given the complexity of the world and given the necessarily partial nature of all economic theories, you should be humble about the validity of your own favorite theory and should keep an open mind about it. Finally, even while I constantly make reform proposals, I emphasize how difficult it is to change the economic reality. Well, sometimes the reason is obvious. I mean, people who benefit from the status quo want to thwart change by any means, you know, lobbying, bribery, media propaganda, and even violence. But the status quo often gets defended even without some people actively being evil. Because the thing about the market system is that the rule is $1, one vote. You know? So this means that the ability of those with less money to refuse undesirable options given to them is highly constrained. Also, we can be susceptible to beliefs that are against our own interests. You know, the best example is that what happened when Barack Obama tried to reform the American medical insurance system, and there were all these pictures of old pensioners demonstrating against what they call Obamacare with placards that saying things like, government hands off my Medicare. Hmm? Well, except that Medicare is a government program. Yeah? Well, this is what the Marxists used to call false consciousness, or also known as the Matrix, yeah? The movie. Yeah? But acknowledging the difficulties involved in changing the economic status quo should not make us give up the fight to create a better economy and better society. Yes, changes are difficult, but in the long run, if enough people fight for something hard enough, many impossible things can happen. Yeah? And don't forget, I mean, 200 years ago, if you suggested America should abolish slavery, you'd have been branded at least unrealistic, yeah? And probably loony. Yeah? 100 years ago, the British government put women in prison for asking for vote. A lot of women actually said, why do we need votes? We have our husbands and brothers to represent our views. Well, this is why I quote Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist, who once said that we need to have pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. Yeah, you have to accept the difficulties of changing the status quo, but you have to believe that this can be done. And finally, as Nelson Mandela used to say, it always seems impossible until it is done.
We'll return after this break.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated in your phone. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker and CITR 101.9 FM, your economical source of science and skepticism. And we're back. Next up in our cavalcade of web wisdom is courtesy of Big Think. We have James Kleck on the brief history of time in science fiction. Let's listen and learn.
If there was one startling fact that got me going on this book, it was realizing that time travel is a new idea. We're so familiar with it. We grow up with time travel. We have time travel in cartoons. We know all of the jokes. We know the paradoxes. It's like part of the fabric of our culture. And it was really a surprise to me to discover that before H.G. Wells, there was almost no conception of time travel. Nobody put the two words together. The Time Machine, his 1895 book, is really the first time people thought there could be such a thing as a time machine. And that just struck me as weird. Because your first impulse is you want to argue with that, probably. I mean, a lot of people think, well, that can't possibly be true. What about this? You know, what about this Greek legend? What about stories told by the ancient Japanese? And there are things where, for example, a fisherman falls asleep and wakes up many generations later and everybody he knows is dead. And that's like the Rip Van Winkle story. And Rip Van Winkle was before H.G. Wells, of course, though not that much more before. And because we have such an expansive sense of time travel ourselves, and we're imaginative people, we can immediately see that, for example, when the Greeks imagined going down to the land of the dead, going to Hades and crossing the river Styx, and meeting their dead ancestors, that's a kind of time travel, we might say. Or anyway, if you're a sci-fi geek, you might be thinking of, you know, racking your brain trying to think of predecessors. And there are things, there are sort of weird things that if you're a geek, you can find. But it's the truth that before the late Victorian era, it was practically impossible for people to conceive of time travel. And I say it was impossible because they didn't. So it raises two questions, two, you know, mirror image questions. Why not before? What was it that made this not a natural way to think about things? And then the other question is, why now? You know, was there something, is H.G. Wells kind of an oddball, a one in a millennium quirk, or was there something in the culture? Was there something about the times that made time travel an interesting or natural or plausible idea? And of course, I think it's the second thing. And that's the point of my book, is to investigate these questions, or at least the starting point of the book is to investigate these questions. One sort of basic thing to say about why it wasn't a natural idea is imagine yourself in the 16th century. You're a farmer, let's say, and somebody asks you, so what do you think life is going to be like for your grandchildren? You would say, what do you mean? That question doesn't make any sense. Life is going to be the same for my grandchildren. Life is the same for me as it's always been. There's nothing different about the world I live in from the world of my known ancestors. The world wasn't changing fast enough for anybody to have a sense of technological progress, much less a sense that technological progress is kind of inevitable, that we are on a conveyor belt bringing us inexorably into the future, right? So you can see that start to change during the Industrial Revolution. The pace of technological change accelerates, and it accelerates to a point when suddenly people can look around and become aware that things actually do change fast. In 19th century England, there were railroad trains, and you could ride a railroad train across the landscape and look out the window and see, you know, a farmer behind a plow, the same kind of plow that his ancestors had been using for 500 years, and you're hurtling across this landscape, and you would be acutely aware that your parents didn't do that. And at the same time, the telegraph arrived on the scene, and things started to change really fast. And you can see in the way people talked about these technologies at the time that they were very aware of these changes. They spoke the way we do today about technological change and how the world is being transformed. And for example, the telegraph is annihilating space and time. That was part of the subject of my last book on information. So H.G. Wells in the 1890s is living in a world where it was possible now for somebody like him, and he was an exceptional person, to become intensely curious about the future, to say, the future is what I care about. He was able to think of himself as a kind of futurist. That was not a word that really existed comfortably in the language, but he used it. And he felt because he was a forward-looking guy, you know, politically forward-looking too. He was a socialist. He thought the smart people, the cool people, should be thinking about what the future is like. And so that's another peculiar fact about his book, The Time Machine, that not everybody remembers, that, you know, he had this time machine and it could go wherever he wanted, but it only goes into the future. H.G. Wells never thought, I can travel into the past. You know, who would I want to meet? Which is the kind of thing we think all the time now, right? A lot of time travel stories involve travel to the past. Of course, there's much more to it. There's much more going on about notions of time, and that becomes, for me at least, that was the fun of doing the book, was to see what was happening. There was a kind of ferment, a kind of upheaval in the way people were thinking about time. Part of it had to do with discovery of geology. People were digging in the earth and looking at buried layers and understanding for the first time that these layers of different kinds of rock, sedimentary, volcanic rock, were a kind of diagram of the earth's history. And at the same time, Darwin had arrived and spoken, and people were understanding something for the first time about the history of life on Earth, and the way the history of life on Earth could be visualized and explored again through buried layers. So there's a kind of spatial metaphor for time. You can look at the Earth, and archaeologists were digging things up and realizing that this is a kind of record, and you can think of time as something extending deep into the earth, for example. I mean, there were a lot of new ways of looking at time. Here's another example. It comes along with instrumentation for thinking about the weather. You have a barometer, and it makes a graph of the air pressure over time. And so the needle goes up and down, and you look at this graph on a paper, and one of the dimensions on the paper represents time. Now, that wasn't a totally new idea in the 19th century. Descartes did that, and Newton did it. They graphed time against space as a dimension. But so there's something that also was coming into people's awareness. And so a funny thing about H.G. Wells's book, to stick with him for a second, is his time traveler, as he calls him, gathers his friends around the fire and explains to them, he mansplains his time machine. And the explanation involves a kind of lesson on science and a lesson about geometry. And he says, the first thing I have to tell you is that everything you think you know about geometry is wrong. They teach you that there are three dimensions, length, breadth, and height, but actually there's a fourth dimension, and the fourth dimension is time. And he explains this to them, and it's a new idea. And by to them, I mean to Wells's readers. You know, in the fiction, he's explaining it to his pals, but of course he's really explaining this brand new idea to the people of 19th century England. Well, to us, that idea is second nature, right? We, you know, time is the fourth dimension. Everybody knows that. We don't exactly learn it in kindergarten, but almost. And it's odd that Einstein was 10 years after Wells. That is, Einstein's very first presentation of the special theory of relativity was 10 years after Wells's time machine. So what am I trying to say here? I am not trying to say that Einstein got this idea from Wells. That would be great if there were any evidence for it, but there isn't any evidence for that, and it would be silly to say that. I'm also not trying to say that Wells was such a genius that he about physics that he anticipated these ideas before, well, he did anticipate them, but he wasn't putting forward a theory of physics. He was not, he never dreamed that 10 years later this would be a new orthodoxy of the most important science that that the professionals were discussing. He thought he was making up a story. He thought he was trying to invent a plausible excuse for this piece of fantastic storytelling that he wanted to sell. It was his first book. He was a young, striving writer trying to make a buck. And for the rest of his life, he lived a long time, and he lived through an era when relativity became well understood, and the time as the fourth dimension became a recognized concept, and people started to take time travel seriously. And those people were generally disappointed in Wells himself, because Wells never did time travel again. He never cooperated with people who wanted to say, you know, could time travel be real? How could we do it? He always said, you know, don't you guys know I'm just telling a story? And so he disappointed his fans, as no doubt I'm going to disappoint my fans when they buy my book hoping to discover the secrets of time travel.
We'll return after this break.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, your favorite time-traveling skeptical radio show. And we're back. Ever wonder how evolution really works? Well, next we have Kurtzig in a nutshell to give us an explanation of evolution. Let's listen and learn.
Mechanisms of evolution. What is evolution? Evolution is the development of life on Earth. This is a process that began billions of years ago and is still continuing to this day. Evolution tells us how it was possible for the enormous diversity of life to develop. It shows us how primitive protozoa could become the millions of different species that we see today. Evolution, then, is the answer to the question that we have all asked on seeing a dachshund and a Great Dane together. How is it possible for ancestors to have descendants that look so very different to them? Answering this question, we want to focus on animals, excluding other forms of life such as fungi and plants. The first question to ask is therefore, how can one animal develop into a whole new species of animal? Ah, but just a quick question. What exactly is a species? A species is a community of animals that is capable of producing offspring with one another, with those offspring also being capable of reproducing in turn. To understand this answer better, we need to take a closer look at the following points. The uniqueness of living creatures, guaranteed through the excess production of offspring and heredity. And, as a second key point, selection. Let's begin with uniqueness. Every creature that exists is unique, and this is essential for evolution. The members of a species may strongly resemble each other in appearance, however, they all have slightly different traits and characteristics. They may be a bit bigger, fatter, stronger, or bolder than their fellow animals. So what is the reason for these differences? Let's take a closer look at a creature. Every creature is made up of cells. These cells have a nucleus. The nucleus contains the chromosomes. And the chromosomes hold the DNA. DNA consists of different genes. And it's these genes that are life's information carriers. They contain instructions and orders for the cells and determine the characteristics and traits that living creatures have. And it's precisely this DNA that is unique to every creature. It's slightly different from individual to individual, which is why each has slightly different characteristics. But how is the enormous range of DNA created? One key factor is the excess production of offspring. In nature, we can observe that creatures generally produce far more offspring than is necessary for the survival of their species, with many offspring dying an early death as a result. Often there are even more offspring than the environment in which they live is able to support. This is one factor in increasing diversity within a species. The more offspring that are produced, the more little differences occur. And this is what nature wants, as many little differences as possible. The second major cause of the uniqueness of individuals occurs in heredity itself. By the way, heredity means the passing on of DNA to offspring. Two very interesting factors come into play in this process: recombination and mutation. Recombination is the random mixing of the DNA of two creatures. When two creatures fall in love and mate, they recombine their genes twice. The first time they do this separately, when they generate the gametes, that is, sperm and egg cells. The gametes take half of the genes and shuffle them. The second recombination occurs when a male inseminates a female. The parents each provide 50% of their DNA, in other words, 50% of their unique traits and characteristics. These are then recombined or mixed, and the result is new offspring. These offspring have a random mix of the DNA, and therefore the traits and characteristics of their parents. This increases the diversity and differences within a species even further. But mutations are also important for evolution. Mutations are random changes in DNA. These can also be described as copying errors within the DNA, triggered by toxins or other chemical substances, or by radiation. A mutation exists when a part of the DNA is altered. These changes are often negative and may result in illnesses such as cancer. However, they may also have neutral or positive effects, such as the blue eye color in humans, which is one such random mutation. In all cases, a mutation has to affect a gamete, that is, a sperm or egg cell, because only the DNA in the gametes is passed on to the offspring. This is also the reason why we protect our sexual organs during X-rays, whilst other parts of the body are not at risk. In summary then, in the heredity process, creatures pass on their characteristics to their offspring in the form of DNA. Recombination and mutation change the DNA so that each child looks different to its siblings and receives a random mix of the characteristics of its parents. There's a key word here: random. All of these processes are based on chance. Random recombination and mutations result in individuals with random mixes of traits and characteristics, which in turn mix these randomly and pass them on. But how can so much be down to chance when all living creatures are so perfectly adapted to their environment? For example, the stick insect, the hummingbird, and the frogfish. The answer is provided by the second key point, selection. Each individual is subjected to a process of natural selection. As we have learned, each individual is somewhat different to its fellows, and there is extensive variation within a species. Environmental influences have an effect on living creatures. These so-called selection factors include predators, parasites, animals of the same species, toxins, changes in habitat, or the climate. Selection is a process that each individual is subjected to. Every creature has a unique mix of traits and characteristics. This mix helps them to survive in their environment, or not, as the case may be. Anyone with an unsuitable mix will be selected from the environment. Those with the right mix survive and can pass on their enhanced traits and characteristics. This is why diversity is so important. This is why creatures make so much effort to produce offspring that are as different as possible. They increase the likelihood that at least one of their offspring passes nature's selection process. They maximize their chances of survival. A good example of this can be seen in a group of finches living on a remote island. They are some of the most famous animals in the world of science and are known as Darwin finches, after their discoverer, Charles Darwin. And this is the story of those finches. A few hundred years ago, a small group of finches was blown onto the Galapagos Islands in the middle of the Pacific, probably by a big storm. The finches found themselves in an environment that was completely new to them, a real finch paradise, an abundance of food and no predators. They reproduced rapidly and numerously. The islands were soon heaving with finches. This meant that food supplies became increasingly scarce. The finch paradise was threatened with famine, and finch friends became competitors. This is when selection intervened. Their individuality and small differences, in this case their slightly different beaks, meant that some of the birds were able to avoid competing with their fellow finches. The beaks of some of the finches were more suitable for digging for worms. Other finches were able to use their beaks better for cracking seeds. The finches consequently sought out ecological niches. In these niches, they were safe from excessive competition. They soon began to mate primarily with other finches that used the same niche. Over the course of many generations, these characteristics were enhanced, enabling the finches to exploit their niches successfully. The differences between the worm diggers and the seed crackers became so large that they were no longer able to mate with one another. Different species emerged as a result. Today, there are 14 different species of finch living on the Galapagos Islands, all of which are descended from the same group of stranded finches. This is how new species are created by evolution. Through the interaction of unique individuals, the excess production of offspring, recombination and mutation in heredity, and finally, through selection. Why is this so important? It tells us where the variety of life comes from and why living creatures are so perfectly adapted to their habitats. But it also affects us personally. Every person is the result of 3.5 billion years of evolution. And that includes you. Your ancestors fought and adapted in order to survive. This survival was an extremely uncertain thing. If we consider the fact that 99% of all the species that have ever lived are extinct, then you can consider yourself part of a success story. The dinosaurs have disappeared, but you are alive, because you're incredibly special. Just like all the other creatures that exist today. Irreproducible and unique in the universe.
We'll return after this break.
Open Media International is a non-profit, non-partisan organization working towards informed, citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR, your Selected for Skepticism radio broadcast. And we're back. Do you trust the news? What about Facebook? Up next, we have PBS Ideas Channel discussing bias and algorithms. Let's listen and learn.
Here's an idea. Even algorithms can't save Facebook from the bias of reporting the news. In case you missed the news because it wasn't trending on Facebook, Facebook's trending news team has been in the news. Not long ago, the whole department got the axe after Gizmodo reported that they've been suppressing conservative news items and sources. This caused a stir, and perhaps rightfully so. Facebook is used by all stripes of people with all manner of beliefs and politics. It's where those people go to get their news. Writing for the New York Times, Farhad Manju described Facebook as the world's most influential source of news, according to every available measure of size. And it would be dismaying, to say the least, to learn that your news source suppresses topics most important to you. Also dismaying because Facebook can actually sway public opinion. Enough people use Facebook, and Facebook is good enough at directing user experience that it is as, if not more, capable than a standard news outlet or the oatmeal when it comes to moving the needle on public perception. I attribute Sriracha's popularity significantly to Matthew Inman. But okay, a timeline. In early May, Gizmodo posts their expose and Facebook denies the presence of bias. The Senate Commerce Committee then demands insight into Facebook's editorial system and wants a list of the news sources removed or blocked from trending. On August 26th, Facebook announces its trending news team would be axed and that the trending algorithm would be significantly more, though not entirely, algorithmic. On August 29th, an article incorrectly claiming Fox News contributor Megyn Kelly was fired for secretly supporting Hillary Clinton trends, and the trending news topics continue to be a shadow of their former usefulness. Let's say. On August 30th, Digiday posts an interview with an anonymous former Facebook trending news editor who confirms that their team, like much of Silicon Valley, was left-leaning, and that though they were a news team in name, there was very little editorial oversight until Facebook got called out. In their words, it never seemed like anyone in the company ever actually understood what we did or understood how the topics were curated. Now it's very easy to understand. Robot brains. In light of this whole thing, there are then two questions that I want to ask. The first is, why is there an expectation that Facebook have zero bias? And second, what does Facebook do in light of that expectation? Right off the bat, we should talk about a thing that we've already talked about. The expectation that any news source will be free from bias is an unfair one. In the past, we've quoted Glenn Greenwald, who has said that there's no such thing as neutrality, only transparency. Journalist and professor Jay Rosen talks about how the view from nowhere, the capability to report on events without personal inclination, is mythological. Neutrality and the view from nowhere are vestiges of a traditionally positivistic approach to journalism, which we learn over and over again is too high an ideal for mere modern mortals. And this is just as true for what Facebook does, aggregation, curation, editorial, publishing, as it is for literal on-the-ground reporting done by people.
Miss, for a dollar, can you believe this is Blake Lively without makeup?
No, she looks good.
Okay, so the first source of an expectation that Facebook itself is unbiased is probably the fact that news feeds are populated by friends. Yes, there is a small cadre of contrarians in everyone's feed, but for the most part, and Facebook understands this, so they design for it, Facebook is for seeing things you like, things that you agree with, things that you are entertained by. That's why the contrarians are so frustrating. They ruin Facebook. The idea here is that Facebook mostly shows things which align with one's worldview because, hey, you are the editorial director of your friendships, and Facebook is the positive reaction skewing editorial director of your friendships on Facebook. So one may start to think of Facebook as unbiased because on two levels, it works to show things that align with one's own bias. That's how ideology functions. The complete absence of tingle is how you know it's working. The trending news pane is a little different though. That purports to show topics that a large number of people are sharing and talking about. If you're conservative and you discover that that's not exactly the case, well, then that's grist for the theory mill. The theory that the mainstream media colludes to silence, or at least not spotlight, your viewpoints because the liberal elite is in your internet messing with your hashtags. Which is exactly what happened. But also, I mean, this is a thing that's widely understood about publishers and news organizations, that they have politics. Facebook trafficking in slant is no different from the rest of the news media. It may not have the same editorial oversights and standards as other news giants, and that is a lamentable problem, but just like where there's smoke, there's fire, where there's editorial, there's partiality. And that is true even when the editorial is guided by code. No one is hanging other major news publishers out to dry for their preferences because, duh, people have preferences, but is Facebook people? It's a weird question to ask, but before this debacle, there was not widespread understanding that Facebook does or even could have bias. Arguably, even Facebook didn't understand. Why? Because algorithms, I think. Facebook is a technology product run by algorithms. What's an algorithm? Well, it's not a person, that's for sure. It's the result of programming and computation and fundamentally dispassion. But also not. Insofar as data collected about the world contains and reflects bias, which it almost certainly does, algorithms that operate on that data will also contain and reflect bias. This is true down to data sets as seemingly neutral as whole languages. Source. For real. It's a recent study. You should read it. The practice of thinking that because a technological operation based on data has transpired, its result must be free of bias is something former Kickstarter VP of data Fred Benenson has described as math washing. Quote, using math terms, algorithm, model, etc., to paper over a more subjective reality. Algorithm and data-driven products will always reflect the design choices of the humans who built them, Benenson said, and it's irresponsible to assume otherwise. Basically, where we may understand news publishers and newsrooms and reporters to have bias because they're people, for better or worse, computers acting autonomously with algorithms and models are often thought to have none, even though that is demonstrably not the case. Sources. So many sources. Endless sources. An embarrassment of sources. They're all good. Read them all. Even trending, which sounds like it should be really simple, like, oh, it's just popular. That is a complicated thing. You know what's always trending? Weather. Lunch. Right off the bat, editorial is required unless you want hashtag lunch in your face all day, every day. It's also in the economic interest of publishers to catch things as, if not before, they trend so that they can ride the wave of eyeballs and clicks, which means trending is often not a fact but a forecast, and we all know the reputation forecasts have. For a lot of people, though, this is exactly the value of trending items. It's not what is, but what will be popular because being ahead of the curve is cool. Also, are trends in an area or worldwide? Are they sorted by language? Facebook is a global service, so pure trending topics would likely never be in just your native tongue. A mistaken perception that algorithms just get it done causes flabbergastery when human involvement in trending topics, which is the norm from the get-go, is reported on in connection with editorial politics, a thing which is inseparable from every form of news, even if it's just curation, even if it's algorithmic curation. As sociologist Zeynep Tufekci said to the Wall Street Journal, choosing what to highlight in the trending section, whether by algorithm or humans, is an editorial process. Facebook is in a get you a man who can do both territory, except on a double axis. Algorithmically powered social connection and news provision for any given person along the political spectrum. This is tough for a thousand reasons. The political climate in general, the political climate of the tech sector, political discourse online, ongoing social media design problems, but it would seem also Facebook itself. Despite somehow becoming a media giant, a publisher and aggregator of content and news and stories, they simply don't seem to have or be interested in strong editorial standards and practices. Perhaps because of a view that algorithms make those things unnecessary. Well, it would seem, in fact, that algorithms may make them more necessary. Georgia Wells for the Wall Street Journal points out, in recent days, the trending lists have appeared more flawed than when humans were in charge. There have been false stories, misidentified keywords, and celebrity gossip in the place of more serious news. So, what's Facebook's response here? They could develop an ecumenical, politically diverse, if not divergent, newsroom, or newsrooms. Abandon the fairy tale of algorithmic objectivity, even as it relates to trending, and just focus on coverage. But can they? Will they? The trending editor that spoke with Digiday guessed that trending news would probably just be shut down entirely. Maybe not because it doesn't work, but because it can't. What do y'all think? Why is there an expectation that Facebook be unbiased, and is it possible for Facebook to meet that expectation? And if so, how?
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker.
Stressed lately? UBC Yoga Club is here to offer you a peace of mind. Come out to any of our 17 weekly classes running 7 days a week, ranging from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. We have a class to accommodate your needs and abilities. Check us out at ubcyogaclub.com.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth. Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. I am here with